from KQED.
This is the California Report podcast. I'm Lily Jamali at KQED in San Francisco.
And I'm Alice Daniel from KVPR in Fresno. Nearly 40,000 University of California workers from two separate unions plan to walk off the job today at campuses and medical centers around the state. KQED's Peter John Schuler reports.
Professional and technical workers represented by UPTI have called a one-day strike to protest what they say are growing levels of income inequality at UC. They'll be joined by service and patient care workers represented by AFSCME. UPTI Executive Vice President Dan Russell.
UC is basically asking us to accept the ongoing outsourcing of jobs and cuts to jobs that remain, and we think that's really unacceptable.
A UC spokeswoman said in an email, it's unfortunate the unions are staging their third strike in less than a year. She says the way to a deal is the bargaining table, not the picket lines. For the California Report, I'm Peter John Schuler.
Western states can finally move forward with a landmark deal to dole out water from the Colorado River. After several years of haggling, California and six other states have agreed on a plan to manage drought on the river, which supplies about 40 million people. The federal government had told the states it would step in if the states didn't find a way to ration the Colorado's dwindling water supply. Brenda Berman is commissioner of the U.S. Bureau of Reclamation.
Since 2000, the Colorado River Basin has experienced historic drought and dry conditions, impacting the lives and livelihoods of millions of people.
But there's a shadow over this kumbaya moment. The biggest user of Colorado River water, the Imperial Valley, is not part of the deal. Local water officials had wanted funding to restore the Salton Sea, a vast inland lake that's drying up. They vowed to keep fighting for it.
Let's go to the Central Valley now, where you are, Alice, over at KVPR in Fresno. You've been reporting on an olive company that says it's going to buy fruit from growers whose contracts were canceled this month by a competitor who's been turning to the Spanish market. Well, one of the interesting things you've been reporting on is how a long-term contract doesn't come without strings, right?
That's right. So here's what Tulare County olive grower Jim Simons thought when he heard his usual buyer, Bell Carter, was opting for imported Spanish olives over his.
The California olive industry as a whole, I think, is actually on the line.
Simons can't compete with subsidies that Spanish farmers get and was worried he couldn't sell this year's bumper crop. But Tuesday, the other California cannery, Musco, agreed to buy from farmers impacted by Bell Carter's decision. Musco spokesman John Sagali says the company will also sign long-term contracts, but only with growers willing to replant their groves more closely together for mechanical harvesting.
And so the contract will come with incentives to help defray the cost for growers to take out their current orchards, plant new trees in the high-density technique.
Sagali says it's the only way Musco can compete with the European market.
So, Alice, thank you so much for finding this really interesting story. I'm curious what the growers had to say when they found out that the cannery, that Musco, was going to be doing this.
Well, let's start with just a little history of olives. Olives have alternate bearing years, which means 1 year, they produce a lot of fruit. The next year, they don't. So last year was not a good year for growers. And this year, they're expecting a huge harvest. Last year, they lost money. This year, they were hoping to make a lot. And when they learned that Bell Carter would not be able to keep the contracts, they were shocked. They really thought that the olive industry was going to fall apart.
Wow. So far from what you've learned in reporting this story, does that seem like a scenario that's likely to play out, this idea that the whole industry is on the line?
Well, I don't think so, because yesterday Musco announced that they would buy this year's harvest from these farmers who were impacted by the contract termination. I think the growers will have to decide whether or not they want to modernize, meaning that they will have to rip out their olive groves and replant more densely.
All right. Alice, thanks for that. We're going to move on now to Sonoma County. Massive flooding late last month there caused an estimated $155 million worth of damage to more than 2,500 homes and businesses plus infrastructure. It also caused flooding and extensive damage in a new shopping development that was recently built in a floodplain in Sebastopol. Here's the thing. That shopping development, management there said it would not flood. KQED's Sonia Hudson reports.
Jackie Wilson's standing in front of her ice cream shop at the Barlow in Sebastopol. It's an upscale outside mall, but it's not open for business right now. Crews are ripping out drywall and cleaning out her neighbor's stores.
I knew that this area tended to flood, but it really wasn't a concern because the Barlow had this elaborate flood log system plan.
The plan involves a specialized team brought in by management that installs interlocking aluminum logs that stack up and prevent water from entering the buildings. They've tested it several times, but when the Barlow was actually flooding,
it was just kind of chaos. Everyone's running around trying to put more flood logs up.
Wilson says at her store, the logs were stacked about 2 feet high.
And how high did it flood here?
Almost 5 feet.
Right now, shop owners say the Barlow is paying to clean out flood-damaged property, but it's unclear who will have to pick up the tab to make repairs. Wilson says the Barlow should.
There was a plan in place. The plan wasn't followed.
Jake Rand owns a sushi restaurant right across from Wilson's ice cream shop.
I've been impressed with the Barlow's response, and I think that they've gone above and beyond.
Rand says nobody, including management, thought the flooding would be as bad as it was. The Barlow did not respond to a request for comment. Sebastopol City Manager Larry McLaughlin says the flood log system met requirements by the Federal Emergency Management Agency, but it wasn't deployed correctly the day of the flood.
If that plan had been properly implemented, it should have done its job and protected those businesses. So you need to get to the bottom of what actually went wrong.
With the changing climate, building in disaster-prone areas has come under more scrutiny. There are a few other vacant lots in Sebastopol's floodplains, and they could be developed. Here's Vice Mayor Patrick Slater.
Are we going to see more of this due to climate change? And what policies can we make that will mitigate climate change?
Slater says he doesn't know enough to say how or if Sebastopol zoning laws should change. For now, he'll continue to defer to FEMA guidelines on building in floodplains. For the California Report, I'm Sonia Hudson.
Two asylum seekers from Honduras had hearings in immigration court in San Diego yesterday. Theirs were among the first cases heard under a pilot program to have asylum seekers wait in Mexico between their days in court. KPBS reporter Jean Guerrero has the story.
The men were transported from a church in Tijuana to San Diego with the help of Immigration and Customs Enforcement on the U.S. side. They listened to a live Spanish translation of their proceedings through headphones. Attorney Robin Bernard of Human Rights First filed a motion for an evaluation of the men's fear of returning to Mexico.
They've received threats, and the shelter that they're staying at has received threats for sheltering asylum seekers. And they've, you know, there have been individuals at the shelter who've been attempted kidnapped, things like that. So they're pretty scared to be there.
The judge granted the motion. The men will remain in U.S. custody until their fears are evaluated, according to Bernard. The Remain in Mexico program is being challenged in federal court by the ACLU and other advocacy groups who say many asylum seekers are not safe in Mexico, particularly in Tijuana, which is seeing record-high homicides. For the California Report, I'm Jean Guerrero in San Diego.
And to talk more about this, the California Report's Alex Hall joins us now from Fresno. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Lily.
Alex, you were just in Tijuana, Mexicali, and Ciudad Juarez. What did you learn when you were there?
So what I learned is that as of now, at least 240 people have been returned to Mexico under the migrant protection protocols. It's been implemented in Tijuana, 2 hours east at Calexico, and in between those two ports of entry. And yesterday, an official with the Department of Homeland Security confirmed that it has now rolled out in El Paso.
And while you were there, you actually met some of the people who have been returned. What did they tell you?
Right. So I spoke with two families and a man requesting asylum alone. They traveled from Honduras and El Salvador mainly by bus and presented themselves at the port of entry in Tijuana and were returned to Mexico a few days later. They're now staying at a shelter in Tijuana that's more like a garage that's open to the elements with rows of tents. Mm-hmm. And most of the migrants that I spoke with said that they left their countries because they're fleeing violence by paramilitaries or criminal groups. A lot of people brought with them proof to show U.S. authorities that they have a real fear of returning home. Most people are now waiting for their court dates, their hearings in immigration court in San Diego. Each of the adults has a piece of paper with instructions to go back to the border on a certain day. The people that I spoke with are scheduled to appear in front of a judge in early April.
One of the things that has concerned a lot of advocates as this policy has been implemented is this idea of navigating, being forced to navigate the U.S. immigration system from the Mexican side of the border. How are they doing that?
When migrants are returned to Mexico under this program, they're given a packet of paper, and included in that is several pages of contact information for free or low-cost legal services. But many of the organizations require clients to be physically present in San Diego or Los Angeles. One man told me that he went down the list and called every group he could, but no one was able to help him. I've been receiving questions from migrants I've interviewed who are in this process and are uncertain about what to expect, especially after last week. There was a lot of confusion over the first round of hearings. The hearings were rescheduled, and some people were not notified in time, so they missed their hearings. There's a hotline you can call to find out when your immigration court date is going to be, but the migrants I spoke with said that they didn't have that number.
That was the California Report's Alex Hall, who is just back from Mexico.
And that's the California Report podcast for Wednesday, March 20th, a production of KQED Public Radio. I'm Alice Daniel.
And I'm Lily Jamali. Have a great day, everyone.
Support for the California Report comes from Collective Health. Learn how Collective Health works before employees and candidates ask for it at smartcompaniesknow.com. Paint Care. Through Paint Care, paint manufacturers make it easier for households and businesses to recycle leftover house paint with over 800 convenient drop-off locations around California. And Eric and Wendy Schmidt, whose Fund for Strategic Innovation supports transformative ideas that benefit humanity while protecting the natural world, recognizing through science the interdependence of all living systems.